everybody. Today's a great day. I get to do what I love most, and that is have a podcast and have a great interview. My name's Stu Turley, President and CEO of the Sandstone Group, and I'm here with John Gutentag, and we had a fantastic podcast a little while ago. John is freezing his bahonkas off in Denver. Now, John is an analyst for the wonderful company Enverus. Inside baseball, I love Enverus. They're good people. But welcome to the podcast, John.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Stu. I really appreciate it.
Well, I love the fact that you're an analyst, because I'm looking at your reports and holy smokes, Batman, that's a lot of work.
I appreciate that. Yeah, it does have a lot of work, but I feel like we get some pretty good insights from it.
Oh, I think so. The market insights are phenomenal, and we got several things to cover in this. And John, just to get it in here a little bit, give us a little bit of background on why you guys write these reports. We are covering the EPA's revised pneumatic rules. You got to love a good rules and everything else. And then the other one is upstream emissions. That's pretty cool. Tell us what prompted this, and then we're going to go into a little bit on each one.
Yeah, sure. So I guess overall for emissions, we've gotten a lot of questions over the last couple of years. There's been a lot more focus on emissions, especially from oil and gas companies. Right. They've been doing a lot of work to reduce their emissions footprint. So we wanted to look at what they're reporting and what trends we're seeing. Are they fulfilling what they're saying they're going to do? How does the data look? That's from the viewpoint of how to put it, like what the market looks like today. But then there's also a regulatory piece and the IRA's methane tax, where some of this emissions data can translate into an actual tax liability starting in 2024. So we want to see the industry trends. And then we also want to see like what that liability can look like. And then its regulations are pretty complicated. Some smaller companies don't have as robust of a regulatory team. So what we try to do is provide some insight into what we're seeing, what we're hearing in our conversations. Right.
Hey, that tax, John, we covered a bit of that in our last one. And that tax stuff's terrible. If you don't hit those numbers, you owe X number of dollars, and you will solve the $32 trillion deficit if you do that. I mean, you got to be prepared with this. You got to have the knowledge, right?
Yeah, yeah. And our overall view is actually that we don't think it's going to be incredibly impactful to everyone. We think it's going to be impactful to a minority of producers because it is that intensity-based tax. Where you only pay tax beyond a certain threshold. So you can emit methane and pay nothing. It's just only when you emit too much per unit of production that you'll end up paying. And when we did our analysis based on 2020 data, it was actually only 30% of gas production falls above that threshold. So 70% of gas production will not be taxed. And that's 2020 data. We think operators are going to continue to reduce their methane emissions before the tax is even implemented. So what our overall view of it was regulation via taxation. So it's not long-term revenue generation. It's the EPA wants to see these methane reductions. It takes a long time for actual regulations to pass and be implemented, which they are trying to do right now. But it was a quicker method to do it this way, is our viewpoint. Okay. So it's just incentivizing early adoption of future potential regulations.
Okay. You just said something that made my head explode.
Yeah.
Okay. I talked about legislation through regulation all the time. And if they can't get it put through, Congress, they regulate it. You just said taxation through regulation. Holy smokes.
Yeah. Almost a little backwards. They even talk about it in their proposal for these new regulations. They anticipate that operators are going to be doing a lot of this stuff voluntarily to reduce methane emissions even before these regulations come into effect. And right now they're just proposed. We don't know what they'll actually look like in a final version. But we have looked at the proposal and looked at some of the things that they're going to require from operators. Right. And if you look at a lot of operators, they're already starting to do these things 4 or 5 years before they would even be required to do them.
Oh, yeah. Hey, are you familiar with the one? There is a pretty fairly large methane cloud in the Permian. I can't remember the basin that it's in right now. And I'm seeing it in the news that somebody has got a gas leak out there and they can't figure it out or anything. That if you have a break in a pipeline and it is huge, would that fit into the taxation or is it just production?
So how the tax works is it's all based off what operators have to report to what's called Subpart W, which is part of the Greenhouse Gas Reporting Program. So it's what they report to the EPA. So you only have to report from certain sources like pneumatic controllers, combustion of gas and diesel, things like that. Right now, today, like if there's a large leak, there's no good methodology to report that. But one of the things we talk about, the pneumatic controller rule change, one thing they propose within that too, separate from pneumatic controllers, is the requirement for operators to report large methane release events under Subpart W. So today they don't report that methane, which would mean it wouldn't get taxed, but they're adding that to where you will report methane, or it's proposed that you'll report methane from these large events, which then would potentially incur a liability. It's not guaranteed. You could still be below the threshold, but it's now reported under Subpart W. So that's what's the baseline for the tax.
Wow. That has serious implications. Yeah, I mean, we're talking serious.
Yeah. We looked at some. There was like the Aliso Canyon gas storage blowout in Southern California, back in 2015, 2016, that released 100,000 metric tons of methane. If you're looking at it in 2026, the methane tax, $1,500 per metric ton, that could potentially be a $150 million liability. Not that they're going to retroactively apply that, but that would be these large events going forward would have the potential to be taxed.
Don't hold your breath. They tax anything, anywhere, anytime, and they may go backward because of this podcast. they get a lot of their information from the Energy Newsbeat podcast. So. Yeah.
That's what's driving these regulations.
Oh yeah, we are a resource. Yeah.
And there's one thing I can mention too about those large release events is that's talking about reporting the emissions. There's also what's called Quad O, is like the actual regulations telling operators like you can or cannot use this equipment and things like that. Right. Well, this is like the frequency you need to be monitoring your well sites. One thing they're adding in that is the super emitter response program. It's proposed. So we don't know if that will end up being in the final version, but that program there is third parties, not the EPA and not the operator themselves, can monitor using approved technologies for large super emitter events like the one you described. And if they see one and can accurately tag it to an operator, they report it to the EPA, and then the EPA notifies the operator, and the operator has 5 days to go check out the site and see if they can figure out what's going on. And then they have 10 days to make corrections, is what like the proposal is right now. So that's separate from the tax or anything like that. That's more, it's almost like third party methane police. And they're anticipating that could be like tech vendors or researchers or, nonprofits, things like that. That's definitely on a lot of companies' radar. That's on our radar. Just trying to see how that will play out.
Okay, my head just exploded because this has far-reaching implications. I'm going to ask two questions on follow-up on this. Scope 1, Scope 2, and Scope 3 is something that you guys have really done well with trying to figure out all that kind of good stuff, you know, on the new emissions, and they're trying to do all that kind of stuff. And so you're talking downstream, you're talking, you know, once the EMP operators drill it, I think that's Scope 1 that they have opportunity to talk about, right?
Yeah,
I
mean, Scope 1's like direct emissions, like burning diesel to drill this well, they're emitting methane from a tank or something like that. Like those are the Scope 1 direct emissions.
Right. And so that's what they're directly going to be involved in this methane reporting, correct?
Correct. Yeah. You only reports ever scope, like any emissions are scope one to something. So like when we drive our car, that's like our scope one emission. That's not the oil company's scope one emissions for the gasoline we're burning. It's like ours. That would be their, what they call scope three. It's like the use of your products. And then scope two is just electricity that you're purchasing and not generating yourself. So it's like what you're doing, and then power and fuel. And then the last piece is the use of your products.
If I could see the EPA or them coming back in and trying to go, if you're on scope one, and I understand where all the rules are coming in on the EPA's revised rules, taxation through regulation. I love that one. And so if they try to do that, I could see them in the future trying to do taxation on all of the scope three or even scope two. And scope two would be refinery, correct? Refinery.
So that would even be scope three, unless you're like an Exxon where you're like the full value chain and you're directly refining your own products. Like for an upstream only operator, when their products are refined, that would be scope three. It's like the use, their product was the crude oil. So they sold it to the refinery to refine it down into the products. And then like it's the whole value chain. It's so complicated though. I really don't anticipate, in my opinion, taxation on that or anything like that. I think you do get pressure from some investors and things like that to take into account your scope three emissions and your overall footprint of your operation. But for when it comes to reporting, the EPA likes to have them report scope one emissions just because that's what they have direct control over. They have asked for comment on should companies report scope two emissions, like the amount of power they're purchasing, because that is almost direct emissions. It's not from the use. It's like if you're buying power instead of generating it, like that's pretty direct use of like, or I guess creation of emissions. But I don't anticipate seeing a scope three tax.
Yeah.
But I mean, anything can happen. So I can't say it won't happen.
No, I agree. You never know. We'll leave that alone. We don't want to get banned off of YouTube here or our podcast, shadow banned. So, you know, this discussion is going around the increased awareness into via satellite, via everything else. And that's how we found that I was reading these stories. They're great about the flaring. And I think that that's great that you have the pipeline awareness through the satellite, through the higher end methodology. I do applaud that for letting people know ahead of time. And this shows you how old I am. I worked on a pipeline back in 1978, and I had to walk the pipeline. I mean, walk the pipeline for breaks back then.
Yeah.
And then I had to carry paint in a backpack so we could paint the poles. By law, we had to walk the pipeline, and I was the newbie or new guy, and I had to, you know, do that. And just as a real quick side note, you would never have to do this, but you had experience in the on the operator, if I remember correctly, out on the well pad, correct?
Yeah, I worked on drilling rigs for like 4.5 years for a directional drilling company. So I was on the service side, but on site.
Yeah, I was in the pipeline in this job, and I'm walking along. I got my big paint cans on, you know, because you have to paint the poles as they're coming across. And I walked into a field, and I felt like something was looking at me. Turned out it was a herd of Brahma bulls.
Oh man.
it was horrible. And I look up and they're looking at me like I'm a dope. I mean, I feel the hair. In fact, still feel the hair going up. And I'm calculating, you know, where these guys are, how heavy my backpack is, and where's the closest fence. And I mean, fortunately, I was young enough that my cowboy boots were going up over my head. So I was running like this, and I hit a barbed wire fence and jumped over it as all these bulls were running after me. And my team member was on the other side laughing so hard he couldn't see straight. And I'm all mangled up in the ditch, and he thought it was funny.
Yeah. I'd probably be laughing too if I was out there with you.
Where's the cell phone back then? Because I would have been a viral episode. Yeah. You know? But I'm sure you've seen things as your experience that, John, and I just want to shout this you out again, because that made such a difference to you as an analyst for Enverus, knowing the well pet.
Yeah, I think it gives me a lot of great context. Like, I had the petroleum engineering degree, and then I have like real on-site experience too. It just gives a lot of good context to like how these operations actually happen, how they work.
Right.
You know, nothing goes according to plan. Everything, like, you're troubleshooting all the time. There's a lot that goes into drilling a well.
But, you know, as we sit here, that experience helps us talk about other things. And it makes it a little easier for me to be able to say, hey, you know, methane emissions, I've seen on a pipeline how that can happen. And I love the new technology to be able to see these things in action. So as we come into this next part here, and in the flaring, your other article in here, I have to hand it to the Texas operators. Over the last several years, they've been voluntarily doing a big reduction in flaring. And correct me if I'm wrong, but in your experience, haven't you seen that when the pipelines are full and storage is full, they do have to flare a little bit? But the amount of flaring that has gone on has dramatically dropped. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. So ever since like it peaked in 2019, can't remember the exact month, but we've seen a very material drop. I believe via satellite, we saw a 67% drop. And then when you look at total U.S. Reported to the EPA, flaring emissions are down 50% from 2019 to 2021. So that's very huge. Huge. Like the flaring decreases are massive. And we've talked to some operators of what they're doing. A lot of operators now, before, you would have to wait for a sales line to be put in. You wouldn't wait. It was sometimes like the sales line for gas would take a long time. So they'd bring a well online, get the oil production because that was hooked up. And then they just flare the gas. So it'd be like routine flaring by design. Now, most operators always wait to have the sales line put in place before they bring a well online. They obtain redundant connections. So instead of only being connected to one system, they want to connect to two different systems. So if one of their third-party gatherers goes down for maintenance or something like that, they don't have to flare. They just swap the valve over and go to the other one. And then they're also working directly with those third-party vendors or gatherers to like work together on solutions for capacity constraints and things like that. Are getting pretty close in the Permian on capacity constraints again. So this is something we're monitoring. But it, like, flaring has definitely been the initial target for operators. I say flaring, and then also a couple lower hanging fruit on the methane side too, like more leak detection, and then pneumatic controllers is a big one.
When we talk also, I love the stories and the other Bitcoin miners and other EMP operators that are using the stranded gas for actually power generation. I love that it turns the Bitcoin mining into ESG funding for Bitcoin until Bitcoin. I think FTX just totally wiped all that out. I mean, people are still mining, but is that taken into any consideration? I did not see that in your reports anywhere on the Bitcoin mining.
Yeah, there's just not a lot of good public data on like how much of that's actually being used. But it is a great example of this gas was being flared. They're now setting it up to mine Bitcoin, and that's offsetting the use of power from somewhere else. Like, they were probably going to mine the Bitcoin anyways, but now instead of using grid power, they're using this, what was originally like a waste product, like the flared gas, which is definitely a big one there. And then like the increased monitoring is also pretty massive. So you've seen a lot of companies move towards using continuous monitoring or aerial flyovers, satellite flyovers, drones. I've even heard dogs. Like, I've heard a lot of different technologies, like using dogs to sniff out leaks.
There's a lady, I'll have to go take a look, but she's a pipeline dog company. And I really like her posts on LinkedIn, pipeline dog or something like that. And I mean, she has dogs that she just, you know, goes and, you know, checks pipelines with dogs. And I think that that's pretty darn cool.
Yeah.
That beats me going out with a herd of Brahma bulls looking at you. I'd let that dog chew on that pipeline or that bull before me again.
Oh, yeah. I see a lot of opportunity for like aerial flyovers, whether for pipelines, because you can cover a lot of it, which we just saw Diversified mentioned yesterday that they just surveyed 11,000 miles of their pipeline voluntarily in 2022. And then they also did nearly 200,000 handheld leak surveys on like 95% of their producing sites in Appalachia. So that's like some examples of them going above and beyond what's required to mitigate methane.
It's kind of funny. My granddad was one of the main guys that discovered the North Slope in Alaska. And then my dad had an oil company and he was flying the pipelines. So he was a pilot and everything else. And there is a huge difference of when he was flying the pipeline, you know, rolling over like this and looking out the window versus flying the pipeline now with tools.
Yeah.
That you, when you fly a pipeline now, it's not nearly as eyeball intensive. You know, back when I did it, I walked and smelled, and then you walk to make sure there's no exposed. I'm sure I didn't get everything. You know,
I mean,
by law, I agree with the law, and I do agree with some of the rules that the EPA is putting in, because the oil and gas is doing so much better now with all this.
Yeah, it's changing the image, or at least the working towards changing the image of the industry of what's been historically assumed of it to what operators are doing today. And there's definitely still a lot more wood to chop. There's a lot more to fix and work on. But when we looked at, we do like kind of a relative benchmarking of most public companies in the US and like what they're doing on environmental topics and things like that. And one thing we looked at was, I think it was 75 or 80% of the operators that we look at have some sort of target in place for reducing emissions. So they have like a publicly stated target, like we're going to do this and this is how we're going to get there. So they typically list out like what they're going to do. Like I was talking about for flaring, they're doing that, or conducting a lot more surveys, replacing pneumatic controllers, electrifying compression. Like they're doing a lot. It's definitely been a lot of momentum the last few years. And they do seem like we work with a lot of these teams and talk to them, and they seem to take it very seriously.
Oh yeah. And now there's been a ton of activity in the change in the ESG investing market. And I've always felt that there is no ESG without accountability. And in order to have accountability, you need data. And that's why I really am a big Enverus fan, is because if you need data in the energy space, you know, Enverus is one of the best ones out there. So when we see the changes, it's kind of fun to see how the technology has changed. I mean, flaring is bad. Do you know off the top of your head whether the Marcellus is, I don't believe the Marcellus, because the Marcellus, if I understand correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, you're the analyst in this podcast. The Marcellus has got takeaway capacity issues. The Haynesville does not, because it's such a easy area to drill. There's lots of takeaway. It goes to the Gulf and has a lot of LNG. The Permian's always been the winner in the problem child. I mean, the ugly baby on the doorstep, you know, is the way I called things in college. But, you know, does that make sense? Is that a fair assessment, or what is your thought on all that?
So yeah, in the Northeast, there's definitely pipeline constraints because it's hard to get pipelines approved. There's a lot of regulatory pressure to not build them. So they're kind of constrained by that. Haynesville, I'm not as familiar with their pipeline capacity constraints, but I am from Louisiana, and it is significantly easier to build pipelines there than it is in the Northeast. There's just a more, I guess, friendly environment towards doing that.
Right.
And then for the Permian, the main issues have been methane leaks and flaring. And I think they've done a great job on flaring. Oh, yeah. And I think they're doing a great job on methane leaks right now. Like I said, there's still a lot more work to be done, but you look at some of these companies and they're making significant progress quickly. And they're like, you'll see these super majors are testing out like 15 different methane detection technologies at the same time, so they can decide what the best methodology is for like mitigating methane leaks. Moving faster than the EPA can. Like, the EPA is encouraging the use of these new technologies, because today, like if you want to monitor a pad, you have to go out there on foot and use like an OGI camera or a gas sniffer. Right. But they're with this new proposal, they want to encourage the use of alternative technologies. So continuous monitoring, aerial flyovers, satellite flyovers. They're giving like a matrix where instead of doing this many on the ground surveys, you can do this many aerial flyovers as long as it has this detection threshold. So I think we're going to continue to see a lot of movement and the methane monitoring space. I see a lot of opportunity for the aerial flyovers because you can group together with multiple operators that are all in the same area and then just have one fly. You don't all have to have a plane flying over. They can just work together as like almost like a consortium of tracking.
Oh, cool.
And they're doing that in the Northeast. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but they're putting together like a group of operators that want to go in on methane monitoring together as like a group effort to change the narrative around gas production, where the upstream emissions aren't the problem. Now you just have to focus on downstream emissions when you're burning it is the goal.
If you remember the name, John, after we record this podcast, shoot it to me and I'll put it in the show notes.
Okay.
Yeah. Because that would be fantastic. You know, we transcribe these and put them out there. So I want to make sure that data point is out there for folks. People actually listen to the podcast, John. So
yeah.
It's kind of cool.
Yeah. I just looked it up. It's AMI. So it's the Appalachian Methane Initiative.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
We'll have that in the show notes.
Okay,
now,
awesome.
John, this was absolutely fabulous. This was your, I'm going to do some inside baseball for you. This was your second podcast, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Your first one was a horrible experience with me on the, on the other one, right?
it was a good experience. You're a good time to
do. Fantastic. But I tell you what, I really appreciate you and Enverus because, man, this was a great one and with good new information that I truly enjoyed. I mean, the oil and gas space is doing great on this. And without having the ESG component of this, there are other products out there that are allowing for ESG to be monitored and financially projected and everything else. And they use a lot of your data and all this. So there's some great stuff out there. And I love the change that the oil and gas space is making. I just want to give a shout out to Nick Deolis. He's the CEO over at CNX Resources up in the Appalachian. I just released his podcast. And as an alternative in the Appalachia in up there, he's looking at producing LNG or compressed natural gas at the wellhead. I'm like, because they can't get pipeline, you know, if there's some that have enough pressure, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. I don't know, what's the right word? I'm trying to think of the right word, but it's like a pretty cool change to see like how these operators are approaching these problems and coming up with unique solutions that have never been used before. Yeah.
Nick is a true industry thought leader. And the fact that CNX as a publicly traded company is now thinking forward, that's only one example of the great energy tech that's coming around the corner. We're coming up to the end of time here. John, what are you seeing coming around the corner for energy tech? Because in your next reports coming out, I'm sure you're going to take some of that into consideration and some other stuff. What do you see coming around the corner?
Related to emissions, I definitely see a lot of satellites launching. So there's Carbon Mapper and MethaneSat. So those will give pretty granular information on methane emissions from satellites. Whereas today, any publicly available data for satellites is pretty coarse. There are some private ones up in the air, like GHGSat, that are very fine resolution, but that gives good widespread views of methane. And then what's it called? Another one would be aerial flyovers. I see a lot of opportunity there, like I mentioned, where groups of operators can go together to go in on aerial flyovers. A lot of opportunity in the continuous monitoring space. There's Project Canary. There's Long Path Technologies. They have a cool technology where it's a tall tower with a laser and it scans like a couple mile radius of all the pads in the area. So you set up each pad with these mirrors and then there's a laser that tracks methane. So it's not, you don't have to have sensors on every pad. There's like one central sensor, which I thought was pretty unique. But there's a lot of the technologies on methane though, like how to find the super emitter events that we call it the known unknown. They don't necessarily get reported every time, so they're not included right. in the report of the missions, but we know they're happening. And there's a lot of focus on preventing that. So I think the technology in the methane space is very exciting there.
So what's on the, we talked, John, about the next steps personally for you. Keep working hard and keep getting after it so you can move up and be CEO of Enveris here. Like, is it a week that's your plan?
Not a week, not that soon, but that's the end goal one day.
Sounds fantastic. Well, John, thank you so much for stopping by, and we'll have all your contact information in the show notes. And I just really appreciate you. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thanks, Stu. I had a good time too.